Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is United States v. Himani, docket number 241234, decided June 18, 2026. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. Ali Himani is a dual citizen of the United States and Pakistan who was born in Texas and uses marijuana about every other day. Suspecting Mr. Himani and his family of terrorism-related activities, the government searched the family home, and Mr. Himani cooperated, surrendering a gun he kept in the house and admitting his marijuana use. Relying solely on that admitted use, the government prosecuted him under the federal statute, Section 922G, for possessing a firearm while being an unlawful user of a controlled substance. The district court dismissed the indictment, the Fifth Circuit affirmed, and the government asked this court to review the case. The question presented was whether the federal statute, Title 18 United States Code, Section 922G, which prohibits the possession of firearms by a person who is an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance, violates the Second Amendment as applied to the respondent. The court held the government's prosecution of Mr. Himani under Section 922G's unlawful user provision is inconsistent with the Second Amendment. To justify the ban, the government relied on an analogy to historical habitual drunkard laws, but those laws targeted different kinds of people, did so for different reasons, and operated in different ways. Taken cumulatively, those differences prove fatal, and the government failed to carry its burden of showing that its prosecution is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. Justice Gorsuch delivered the opinion of the court, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas, Sotomayor, Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Jackson joined. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion. Justice Jackson also filed a concurring opinion, in which Justice Sotomayor joined. Justice Alito filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, in which Justice Kagan joined. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. This is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. You can find a link directly to the opinion in this episode's description. As the audio is AI-generated, you may hear some audio glitches, including odd pronunciation, noticeable pauses, or repeated words. We do our best to remove these and hope they do not impact your listening experience. The following is the opinion of the court in United States v. Himani.
Ali Himani, the respondent, uses marijuana a few times a week. That fact alone, the government says, means he is automatically banned from possessing a firearm under federal law. And because Mr. Himani admits he owns a gun despite this ban, the government now seeks to prosecute him, imprison him for up to 15 years, and disarm him for life. This case poses the question whether the government's prosecution of Mr. Himani is consistent with the Second Amendment. The Federal Gun Control Act prohibits various categories of people from possessing guns. These categories, listed in Title 18 United States Code, Section 922G, include individuals convicted of crimes punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year, fugitives from justice, and those convicted of domestic violence crimes. This case concerns another of the statute's provisions. Under its terms, anyone who is an unlawful user of or addicted to a controlled substance is automatically banned from possessing a gun. And for defying this ban, an individual can face up to 15 years in federal prison and disarmament for life. To define the term controlled substance, Section 922G relies on the Controlled Substances Act, CSA, enacted to protect the health and general welfare of the American people, Title 21 United States Code, Section 801, the CSA sets forth 5 schedules of controlled substances subject to varying degrees of regulation. They range from Schedule 1 drugs with a high potential for abuse and no currently accepted medical uses like heroin, to Schedule 5 drugs with the lowest potential for abuse and many accepted medical uses like Tylenol with codeine. By incorporating the CSA definition of the term controlled substance, Section 922G makes it illegal for anyone who unlawfully uses any drug found on any of the CSA's schedules to possess a firearm for any reason, upon threat of imprisonment and permanent disarmament. Convictions for violations of Section 922G account for only about 5% of all Section 922G convictions, according to the Congressional Research Service, Guns and Drugs, A Brief History of Title 18, United States Code, Section 922G, published 2026. But, the government insists, a conviction is warranted in this case, and the facts giving rise to it unfolded this way. Mr. Hamani is a dual citizen of the United States and Pakistan who was born in Texas and has spent most of his life there. In recent years, he has lived in the Dallas area with his parents and worked a stable job. But, suspecting Mr. Hamani and his family members of terrorism-related activities, the government conducted a search of the family home in 2022. Throughout the process, Mr. Hamani proved cooperative. He surrendered a gun he kept in the house and pointed agents to some marijuana on the property. He also consented to an interview, telling law enforcement agents that he used marijuana about every other day. After the agents found cocaine in his parents' closet, Mr. Hamani claimed ownership of that as well, though he maintained that his mother had hidden it from him and that he had not used any recently. More than 6 months after the search, the government brought a single charge indictment against Mr. Hamani. The charge had nothing to do with terrorism, the reason for the search in the first place, nor did the charge involve possession of cocaine, drug trafficking, or anything like that. Instead, relying solely on his admitted use of marijuana about every other day, the government prosecuted Mr. Hamani for knowingly possessing a gun in his home while being an unlawful user of a controlled substance. For that alone, the government claimed, Mr. Hamani faced up to 15 years in prison and disarmament for life. No matter that the government did not assert Mr. Hamani was a drug addict, no matter that it did not contend his drug use had ever led him to pose a danger to himself or others, no matter, too, that the government did not claim Mr. Hamani had done anything with his gun other than possess it in his home, Mr. Hamani moved to dismiss the indictment, arguing that the government's effort to enforce Section 922G against him violated the Second Amendment. The district court granted the motion, and, after an unsuccessful appeal to the Fifth Circuit, the government asked us to review the case. We agreed to do so. The Second Amendment protects the right of all Americans to keep and bear firearms for self-defense. Of course, like most individual rights, the Second Amendment has its limits. American legislatures have long regulated the possession and use of firearms to some degree. But when the government crosses the line from permissible regulation into unconstitutional infringement, courts have a duty to say so in the cases before them, no less in the Second Amendment context than in any other. To determine when the government infringes the Second Amendment, we begin by asking whether the amendment's terms cover the conduct in question. If so, the Constitution presumptively protects it. To overcome that presumption, the government then bears the burden of showing its regulatory efforts are consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. Our cases demand this attention to history, we have said, because the Second Amendment was designed to codify a pre-existing individual right and guard against its later erosion by majoritarian legislation or judicial fiat. At the same time, we have recognized that the regulatory challenges posed by firearms today are not always the same as those earlier generations faced. Accordingly, to show that a contemporary regulation is consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, we do not require the government to point to a historical twin or precise historical precursors. Instead, we have said, the appropriate analysis involves considering whether the challenged regulation is consistent with the principles that underpin our regulatory tradition. And, to that end, the government may reason by analogy, showing that its contemporary regulation is relevantly similar to ones well established in the nation's history. While we have not yet had cause to exhaustively survey the features that may render a modern law relevantly similar to historical ones, we have said two play a central role. Call them the why and how. The more closely a contemporary law mirrors a well-established historical analog in purpose and operation, the more likely it is to be upheld. Conversely, the more a modern law diverges from traditional laws in purpose and operation, the less likely it is to survive review. The government accepts all this. It agrees, too, that Section 922G's unlawful user provision burdens conduct presumptively protected by the Second Amendment. After all, that statute bans a class of people, including Mr. Hamani, from possessing essentially any firearm for any purpose. As a result, the government acknowledges it has a burden to carry. The burden the government sets for itself in this case is a considerable one. As the government construes Section 922G and seeks to apply it here, the law automatically bans an individual from possessing a gun from the moment he becomes an unlawful user of any controlled substance until he ceases being one. The law, says the government, doesn't require anything more. It doesn't matter what controlled substance an individual uses, in what amounts he does so, or whether his drug use has ever made him a danger to himself or others. It doesn't even matter why he keeps a gun or how safely he does so. And for violating this automatic ban, the government insists, an individual like Mr. Hamani may be sent to prison for up to 15 years and disarmed for life. To meet its burden of showing a law like that is consistent with the nation's tradition of firearm regulation, the government relies on an analogy to what it calls habitual drunkard laws. These laws, the government submits, enjoy deep roots in the country's history and are relevantly similar to the regulation it wishes to enforce against Mr. Hamani. In truth, the habitual drunkard laws the government invokes fall into three general categories. First, are vagrancy laws. Both at the founding and in the decades following it, vagrants, a group that sometimes included habitual drunkards, could be confined in a workhouse or jailed. Second are civil commitment statutes. Around the same time, many states allowed courts to appoint guardians for various individuals, including habitual drunkards, or authorize their commitment to asylums. Third are surety laws. Under them, judicial officers, again in the founding era and later, could compel habitual drunkards and others to post surety bonds to ensure their good behavior. A person who failed to post bond, the government explains, would be jailed, while a person who posted bond and then misbehaved would forfeit the bond. These laws, the government insists, mirror Section 922G's unlawful user provision in three important respects. Two might be said to concern the why associated with these laws, the last their how. First, the government says, historical laws targeted habitual drunkards for the same reason. Section 922G targets unlawful users because they regularly use intoxicants. Second, the government submits, habitual drunkard laws restricted the liberties of people to the same end. Section 922G does. To protect the public from unusually dangerous individuals who commit violent crimes. Finally, the government argues the historical laws it cites operated in practice much like Section 922G works. The former allowed governments to detain people in places where they could not bear arms, while Section 922G temporarily disarms unlawful users. All told, the government contends, because historical habitual drunkard laws resemble Section 922G's unlawful user provision in so many pertinent respects, that provision must be constitutional as applied in this case and others. We disagree. We appreciate that drugs and guns can sometimes make for a dangerous mix. We appreciate, too, that the government's effort to analogize a modern statute addressing drug use to historical laws must be approached with a sensitivity to the fact that many drugs well known today were unknown in early America. As we have put it, the Second Amendment can and must apply to circumstances beyond those the founders specifically anticipated. But, even taking all that into account, the government cannot carry the burden it has set for itself. We decide cases based on the historical record and arguments compiled by the parties before us. And the habitual drunkard laws on which the government relies here differ dramatically from Section 922G's unlawful user provision on every single metric the government invites us to consider. They targeted different kinds of people, did so for different purposes, and operated in different ways. Whether any one of these problems taken in isolation would prove fatal to the government's cause, we need not decide. Taken cumulatively, we hold, they certainly do. And, apart from pointing to habitual drunkard laws, the government has not even attempted to prove that any other specific historical principle might justify its prosecution in this case. Start with the government's first point of comparison. In its view, the reason why vagrancy, civil commitment, and surety laws targeted habitual drunkards is closely analogous to the reason why Section 922G's unlawful user provision targets unlawful users. Both groups regularly use intoxicants. It's a claim difficult to square with the historical record. Around the time of the founding and for decades following it, a habitual drunkard was, as one court put it, someone who for any considerable part of his time was intoxicated to such a degree as to deprive him of his ordinary reasoning faculties. A regular or even frequent drinker did not usually fit the bill. A man who was intoxicated or drunk one half his time was more like it. In an early American medical treatise, Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, offered this description from a habitual drunkard about the depths of his condition. Were a keg of rum in one corner of a room, and were a cannon constantly discharging balls between me and it, I could not refrain from passing before that cannon in order to get at the rum. Just consider how some of the statutes the government relies on define the term. To qualify as a habitual drunkard under an early Arkansas law, someone had to drink to such excess that he was incapable of conducting his own affairs. A statute in the Minnesota Territory required an individual to be mentally incompetent. A Connecticut law spoke of a person who had lost the power of self-control. And in a statute governing the District of Columbia, Congress defined a habitual drunkard as any person who, by the use of intoxicating liquors, has lost self-control or become incapable of proper attention to the care and management of his affairs, or habitually or periodically neglectful thereof, or dangerous to himself or others. Had habitual drunkard laws applied to those who simply drank regularly, many notable early Americans could have faced trouble. John Adams took a tankard of hard cider with his daily breakfast. Some say James Madison consumed a pint of whiskey daily. Madison championed wine as a healthier and more respectable choice. George Washington often drank 3 glasses of Madeira in the evening, not enough to be considered a heavy drinker in his day. Thomas Jefferson enjoyed 3 or 4 glasses of wine at dinner. In fact, just a few days before the framers signed the Constitution, a farewell party gathered for General Washington at Philadelphia's City Tavern, where 55 guests are said to have ordered. 54 bottles of Madeira, 60 bottles of wine, 8 bottles of Old Stock, 22 bottles of porter, 8 bottles of cider, 12 bottles of beer, and 7 large bowls of punch. There was, in short, a culture of copious drinking in early America. Indeed, in 1829, the Secretary of War estimated that 3/4 of the nation's laborers drank at least 4 ounces of distilled spirits every day. Even the American Temperance Society called those who drank 12 ounces of hard liquor daily mere occasional drunkards. As the Society saw things, it took 24 ounces to qualify as a confirmed drunkard. Given all this, it seems the government's historical laws targeted habitual drunkards not merely because they regularly used intoxicants, or even sometimes used them to excess. Instead, those laws focused on habitual drunkards because their drinking rendered them practically incapacitated and incapable of managing their affairs. And that hardly compares to whom Section 922G's unlawful user provision targets on the government's account. To be sure, the government construes the term unlawful user to embrace only habitual or regular users, not those who use drugs irregularly. But even on that understanding, Section 922G automatically disarms anyone who regularly uses any amount of any controlled substance for anything other than its prescribed purpose. The law, the government insists, does not require it to show that a particular individual is regularly incapacitated, much less incapable of conducting his affairs or a threat to himself or others. Put simply, on the government's telling, Section 922G sweeps in large numbers of people without regard to whether their substance use has the kind of incapacitating effect on them that historical habitual drunkard laws normally required. This case illustrates the disconnect. The government considers Mr. Hamani an unlawful user of a controlled substance because he admits to using marijuana about every other day. But how much marijuana does Mr. Hamani use, in what potency, and to what effect? Is he routinely unable to manage his affairs, a risk to himself or his family? Or does he use a mild gummy as a sleep aid a few times a week? We do not know, and, the government says, it doesn't matter. The government asks us to analogize him to a habitual drunkard all the same. Nor does the government's theory stop at Mr. Hamani. It extends equally to a husband who regularly takes his wife's prescription Ambien to sleep, and a college student who routinely uses a friend's Adderall to cram for exams. The drug involved makes no difference, nor, again, does it matter how much an individual uses or the effects it has on him. That someone regularly uses any substance found on any of the CSA's 5 schedules for anything other than its prescribed purpose is enough. Without more, the government asks us to analogize all such persons to habitual drunkards. To state the analogy is to expose its deficiency. This divergence is not the government's only problem. The government faces more trouble yet when it comes to its next argument. It contends that Section 922G disarms unlawful drug users to protect the public from unusually dangerous individuals who will misuse firearms to commit violent crimes. And, the government submits, early American vagrancy, civil commitment, and surety laws shared a similar purpose. But even spotting the government its assertion about Section 922G's aims, something we will return to later, the government misapprehends the purposes animating the historical analogs it invokes. Usually, they had little to do with protecting the public from categorically violent and unusually dangerous persons. Begin with the vagrancy laws. As a rule, they targeted individuals who did not meet the societal expectation of work. Routinely, that category included not just habitual drunkards, but also vagabonds, common beggars, pipers, fiddlers, stubborn servants or children, and common nightwalkers. Add to that list perhaps any others who would not provide for themselves or the support of their families. Some laws confined vagrants to workhouses where they could be set to work. Other statutes authorized short jail terms. Either way, laws like these might have sought to promote productivity and suppress any number of real or perceived vices. But they scarcely focused on protecting the public from a category of unusually dangerous persons. A similar story unfolds when it comes to what the government describes as civil commitment laws. Consider the first such law the government cites, an 1827 act in the Michigan Territory, worried that habitual drunkards oftentimes wasted their estates by excessive drinking, and thereby involved themselves and their families in distress, misery, and ruin. That law permitted a probate judge to assign a guardian to a habitual drunkard to take care of such person and his estate. Or consider a law the government cites from later in the 19th century. It authorized courts to confine habitual drunkards to asylums in order to prevent them from using intoxicating liquors and reform them. By their own terms, laws like these did not seek to protect the public from violence so much as to protect habitual drunkards from themselves and their families from financial devastation. Last, turn to the surety laws. In Rahimi, we rejected a facial challenge to Section 922G, a provision that prohibits firearm possession by certain individuals subject to domestic violence restraining orders. In reaching that decision, we analogize the modern statute in part to historical surety of the peace laws. Those laws generally required an individual shown to pose a specific threat of violence to post a bond and pledge to keep the peace. Failure to post a bond meant jail, and disturbing the peace after posting a bond meant forfeiting it. Some surety of the peace laws we held were designed to prevent violence and targeted the misuse of firearms, much as Section 922G seeks to do. Notably, the government doesn't rely on surety of the peace statutes in this case. And that makes sense. To warrant the imposition of a surety of the peace, just being a habitual drunkard wasn't usually enough. So in this case, the government directs us to a different kind of surety statute, one that required certain individuals to sureties of good behavior. Under those laws, a judicial officer could impose a surety of good behavior on individuals who threatened a scandal. And a scandal could include anything from haunting bawdy houses to eavesdropping to, yes, being a common drunkard. In fact, one surety statute targeted those who had a common practice of getting drunk and profane cursing and swearing and blasphemy to the great dishonor of Almighty God. But what does any of this prove? To impose a surety of good behavior did not normally require a showing that an individual posed a threat of violence. Instead, these laws usually sought to protect the community from scandals against good morals. And that is nothing like the purpose the government ascribes to Section 922G's unlawful user provision. The government's difficulties do not end with the why comparisons it invites us to make. They also extend to the how. Even when a law regulates arms bearing for a permissible reason, we have said, it may not be compatible with the Second Amendment if it does so to an extent beyond what was done at the founding. And the way habitual drunkard statutes worked in the past differs significantly from how Section 922G's unlawful user provision works today. The historical laws the government identifies usually provided some form of process before an individual lost any of his liberties, even temporarily. Normally, a vagrant could be sent to a workhouse or jail only upon a conviction. Generally, a habitual drunkard could be assigned a guardian or committed to an asylum only after proceedings before a probate court or something like it. And, typically, surety statutes required a proceeding before a justice of the peace or a comparable officer before a bond could be ordered or, if a bond wasn't posted, before a jail sentence could be imposed. None of that holds true for Section 922G. On the government's account, the statute automatically divests an individual of his constitutional right to bear arms the moment he becomes an unlawful user and until he ends his drug use, all without any pre-deprivation process. To be sure, and as the government highlights, an unlawful user who violates this ban is entitled to a full-dress criminal trial before he can be imprisoned or permanently disarmed. But be that as it may, Section 922G offers an unlawful user no pre-deprivation process before his temporary disarmament. The very burden, the government says, is akin to the burden vagrancy, civil commitment, and surety laws imposed on habitual drunkards. We see one more problem yet with the government's submission. Recall its claim about Section 922G's why. The government argues that, consistent with historical laws, Section 922G's unlawful user provision disarms individuals who are, as a category, violent and unusually dangerous. So far, we have spotted the government its assertion about Section 922G's purpose. But there are at least two reasons to doubt it has established even that much. The first has to do with Section 922G's reliance on the CSA. The former does not define its own category of people to disarm. Instead, according to the government, it disarms anyone who regularly uses any drug found on any CSA schedule for something other than its prescribed purpose. The CSA, in turn, was adopted to protect the health and general welfare of the American people. Drugs can be added to its schedules for a variety of reasons, having little or nothing to do with their potential to induce violence. Reasons that include the state of current scientific knowledge about a substance, whether that substance is an immediate precursor to another controlled substance, and the risk to public health. Without question, some unlawful users of controlled substances can pose a risk of violence. But, by defining its scope through the CSA, a statute animated by a variety of other concerns, it is far from obvious that Section 922G confines its reach to those who are categorically and unusually dangerous. The second reason has to do with the government's approach to the drug at issue here. As this case came to us, marijuana was listed on Schedule 1, a schedule reserved for drugs with a high potential for abuse with no currently accepted medical use. But after we heard oral argument, the government moved some marijuana products to Schedule 3, a schedule that applies to drugs with a lower potential for dependence and abuse, and for which a currently accepted medical use exists. Years before that, too, the Department of Justice issued a memorandum directing federal prosecutors nationwide to curtail their enforcement efforts against marijuana users, even while all marijuana products remained on Schedule 1. Seismic changes followed that memorandum. While marijuana use largely remained unlawful under federal law, the number of federal offenders sentenced for possession of marijuana dwindled, and most states responded by legalizing marijuana use to one degree or another as a matter of state law. 40 states, 3 territories, and the District of Columbia have legalized some marijuana use. As a result, some surveys suggest there now may be more adults in this country who regularly use marijuana than consume alcohol. See the report in Changes in Self-Reported Cannabis Use in the United States from 1979 to 2022, published in 2024, in which it states for the first time in 2022, more individuals who self-report daily or near-daily marijuana use than alcohol use. Whatever one thinks of these developments, the federal government has not just tolerated them, it helped fuel them, all of which leaves it awkwardly positioned to suggest that the millions of Americans who now regularly use marijuana are categorically and unusually dangerous. In saying this much, we do not question that sometimes an individual's unlawful use of marijuana or any other controlled substance may render him a danger to others. But, again, the government disclaims the need to show anything like that in this case. Instead, it asks us to conclude that anyone who regularly uses marijuana is categorically violent and dangerous without any further showing, all based on little more than its current say-so, one at odds with its own regulatory actions, and affording the government that kind of broad power to designate any group as dangerous and thereby disqualify its members from having a gun would risk allowing it to quickly swallow the Second Amendment. In many respects, this case is a narrow one. We do not address efforts to ban addicts or those presently intoxicated from possessing a firearm. We do not address other prophylactic laws Congress might adopt after determining that users of a particular drug pose a special risk of misusing firearms. We do not address Section 922G's provision disarming individuals convicted of felonies, often including drug-related ones. We do not even address whether the government could bring a prosecution under Section 922G accompanied by individualized proof that the defendant's use of marijuana or any other drug renders him a danger to himself or others, or proof that a certain drug always renders its users dangerous because of its potency, or for some other reason. None of those issues is before us, and we do not pass on them either way. All that is before us is one, if surely ambitious, theory. The government maintains that it may automatically strip Mr. Hamani of his Second Amendment right to possess a firearm because he uses marijuana a few times a week. More than that, because he possessed a gun despite this prohibition, the government insists it may imprison him for up to 15 years and disarm him for life. According to the government, none of this turns on how much marijuana Mr. Hamani uses or what effect it has on him. It makes no difference either. If he keeps a firearm only in his home for self-defense, never misuses a gun while intoxicated, and never poses a danger to himself or others as a result of his marijuana use. The only thing the government must show, it says, is that an individual like Mr. Hamani regularly uses any amount of any controlled substance. To square that expansive theory with the Second Amendment, the government invites us to draw an analogy between its present regulation and historical laws addressing habitual drunkards. Those laws, the government contends, demonstrate a tradition of firearm regulation consistent with its effort to disarm any regular user of any controlled substance without any further showing. But the government's analogy fails under every measure it asks us to consider. The historical laws on which it relies targeted different kinds of people, did so for different reasons, and operated in different ways. And faced with all these shortcomings in the government's submission, we cannot say it has carried its conceded burden of showing its prosecution of Mr. Hamani complies with the Second Amendment. The judgment of the Fifth Circuit is affirmed. It is so ordered.